Faster Mai, good evening and welcome to episode 3 of Responders. Tonight on the programme we're looking at the Fire and Rescue Service. A little bit later on we'll be speaking to representatives of the island's Civil Defence Corps too. But first we're going down to Douglas Fire Station where I spoke to Station Officer David Cowley. I'm on fire.
Okay, so we have two aerial ladder appliances.
Aerial ladders, so...
Yeah, so they're used for rescues from, say, above the second, third floor, where our ladders won't usually reach. We've also got the enhanced rescue vehicle, which is used for primarily road traffic collisions. It's also got heavy rescue gear. It's got trench rescue gear. It's effectively our biggest toolbox on wheels.
Cool.
So that comes out to quite a number of incidents for us. We have three major pumping appliances, which is what people commonly refer to as a fire engine. So big tanks of water, a tank of foam on there as well, ladders, hose, breathing apparatus inside. And that's what we would usually respond to an incident with. So we have three of those at Douglas.
When would you use water and when would you use foam?
Right, okay. Totally dependent upon what's on fire, really. For majority of fires that we go to, the application of water is perfectly fine. However, if we have something like oil fire, then we'd use foam, obviously, because the oil would react violently with the water as well, and then it could cause expansion and further problems that way.
And how much water would you be carrying on one of these things?
We've got 1,800 litres of water on each major appliance, and we've also got 200 litres of foam. However, for larger scale fires and fires where we haven't got a readily available water supply, we also have a water carrier as well. And that carries thousands of litres on it.
So these are the, what did you call them, the pumping machines or something? The fire engines?
Yeah, or major appliances. They're water tender ladders, but most people just refer to them as fire engines, most of the public. Yeah. But we refer to them as major appliances. And then we also have an incident command unit where we have to set up effectively a mobile office to coordinate larger scale incidents. And we have some smaller fleet vehicles as well, which we use for incidents also. Jim, through there. We have our maintenance areas for our breathing apparatus sets as well. So maintenance for breathing apparatus we do in-house as well. So we have trained technicians to service and repair breathing apparatus sets. And that saves having to send them away. So we've got that level of resilience in-house, which means that if things do go wrong, we can quickly repair them and get things back on the run.
So would you find that in a fire station in England, or is that something special to hear?
I think I wouldn't like to comment on what the UK services do.
Fine.
However, for an island fire service, it's really important that we're relatively self-sufficient. If I use a county service in the UK, for example, if they run out of people, resources, equipment, they can relatively easily call on the county close by to come and assist.
Yeah.
Whereas as an island fire service, we need to make provision for the worst-case scenario with the people and resources we've got. We have a water rescue team. Thankfully, we don't have vast expanses of water inland on the island, and our colleagues at the Coast Guard obviously cover, and the lifeboat cover the surrounding waters. But on occasion where we do have difficulties inland water, then we've got a team there ready to respond as well. And we also have a search team, used to be called the Hill Search Team. So if people have difficulties on the hills, or the mist comes in, Manannan's cloak comes down, they get lost or they get injured, we have personnel and resources ready to respond to assist them as well.
It seems like you've got a pretty good relationship with the other emergency services.
We have to work quite closely with them. No one emergency service can deal with everything independently, so it's important that cross-service relationship is built and maintained as well.
Everywhere I go doing this programme, I say, so what would sort of a typical day be like? And I get the same answer everywhere.
There's no such thing as a typical day. We do have, in all fairness, though, we do have set routines that we have to follow. So we have a weekly work routine. So personnel come in on duty. They have to do certain emergency checks, whether it be on vehicles, appliances, equipment, their PPE. So everything has to be checked just to make sure it's ready to go if needed. As you say, a typical day would usually involve training, one, potentially two training sessions per day, maintenance of hydrants around the island as well, personal development, because everyone has to go through a development process to become a qualified firefighter, and then we have incidents on top of that as well. So it's very, very varied day by day.
How long does it take to become a
qualified firefighter?
From the point of being accepted into the service, or passing the interview and starting on your first day, it's a 4-year process to become qualified. And once you are qualified, then you're eligible to either go for a promotion or continue in your role as a firefighter.
How many firefighters do we have working here in Douglas Fire Station?
In Douglas, we're split into 4 watches, red, green, blue and white, and each watch has 8 personnel on. That consists of 2 officers per watch and 6 firefighters. So effectively, we have 24 firefighters at Douglas. Seems like an awful lot, but on duty at any one time, we have between 5 and a maximum of 8 personnel. So if you consider the amount of appliances and the amount of varied incidents we have to respond to, yeah. 8 personnel at one time is not a lot. So we rely on people being called in from their home address or from their personal activities to come in and support the duty crew.
I was just having a count there. I can see 7 vehicles. I've seen at least one. Like there's a lot of vehicles here and not that many people here at any one time.
There are quite a number of vehicles. However, as I said before, they're specific to the types of incidents that we respond to.
Now, if someone wants to join the fire brigade, if they want to become a firefighter, what sort of thing will they have to do?
Well, I'll have to correct you there, Will. It's the Fire and Rescue Service now. We used to be.
I'm sorry.
We used to be a brigade years ago. Now, because of the disciplines that we have to train in and what we respond to, it's the Fire and Rescue Service. And you're right. To become a firefighter and to go through recruitments, we will be starting our recruitment process soon, possibly mid-September. There will be some come and try it nights beforehand, so people can come down and get a little bit of a taste of what we're about as well, so you're not just applying for a job effectively blind. I think there's still perception out there that we do certain things or don't do certain things, but I think the more people engage with us, the more we engage with the public, they'll actually realise that we're a very varied service and we do have a lot to offer people as well.
So you're talking about cats down from trees and things?
That used to be the favourite one, cats from trees, amongst other things.
Do you ever go to cats that are stuck in trees?
Not personally now, no. We haven't for a while anyway. No, but I must stress though, the varied nature of this job, it means we do put a lot of emphasis on training. It is a big commitment. It is hard to provide that commitment. But if you do provide this and you do train hard, it's very, very rewarding. Certainly in the 16, 17 years I've been here, I've never had 2 days the same. So I would definitely recommend anyone who's interested, come down and see what we're about.
Have you, if I think about firefighters, you're attending these incidents sometimes. Is it ever difficult to deal with what you've seen sort of personally, if you see what I mean?
I wouldn't like to speak on behalf of everybody, but I'm sure that there's been situations, because we are a small island, where people know the individuals, either whether it be directly or indirectly, who are involved in some of the incidents we attend. So we do have quite a lot of focus on making sure that our crews are fully debriefed after each incident, and that there is that level of support available to staff as well. And it might not just be straight away, it could be a few years down the line, so we've got to make sure that we all feel supported and we're there for one another. In addition to actually the operational response, so in other words, when things go wrong, we're called upon to then come out and deal with the incident. And prior to that, we've also got prevention and protection. I mean, the 3 things for the fire service are prevent, protect and respond.
Right.
Respond being the last thing on the list. Prevention is we try and educate people and prevent them from getting into that situation in the first place. Protection is more linked into our fire safety department, who will have legislation to support certain fire precautions in buildings, whether it be hotels, boarding houses, pubs, clubs, and the certain levels of fire protection that they must adhere to. We also had a slot at the college, which was called Crucial Crew, which managed to get that information out to all year 6 level students across the island, which was really beneficial. So by starting at a very young age, it kind of puts kids or allows kids to develop that mindset of safety in the home.
It's funny, actually. I still remember being shown these pictures of it. It's the one where someone's charging their laptop on their bed or something and it causes a fire. I remember that from Crucial Crew.
Yeah, well, hopefully you haven't done it since.
No, yes, I can safely say it's worked for me and I think many other people probably.
I think it's very important for the fire service and for public as a whole just to get that safety message across to children while they're a little bit younger. Minds are a little bit more receptive, and as you've just evidenced there, it tends to stick with you as well as you grow through your years.
We're in Douglas Station here. we've got other fire stations around the island.
Yes, that's right. We've got 7 stations around the island. Douglas is the only whole-time or the full-time crewed station. We also have Laxey, Ramsey, Kirkmichael, Peel, Maloo, and Russian. All of the other stations apart from Douglas are retained, and when I say that, it means that the on-call personnel will be going about their normal business, their normal places of employment, their hobbies, and if there is an incident in those areas, they'll be called in via an alerter, they'll break away from what they've been doing, respond to their respective fire stations, and then go out to the incident. The majority of our workforce actually operates that retained system, and they will also be involved in our recruitment process because we will be recruiting for retained firefighters at all these various communities around the island.
So are retained firefighters volunteers?
They're not volunteers, no. They are paid for their services to the Fire and Rescue Service. They train 3 hours per week, which is, they've got an awful lot of training that they need to go through within those 3 hours every week. And then the majority of their commitment is actually being available on call to respond to incidents. I'm on fire.
When I was down at Douglas Fire Station, as well as speaking to David in that interview, I also watched as the team undertook a hazardous materials exercise. The incident commander for the drill was Murray Halsall, and he can explain what was going on.
So we set up a scenario today. The crews are attending a hazmat incident for hazardous materials. It's a clinical waste management company that they've been told to respond to. They've been instructed that the workers at the building have found a white powder substance. They're not sure if it is a substance that they use within the building themselves, so they've requested the attendance of the fire service to identify what this unidentified powder is.
So you're at this company, for example, and how are you going to identify what it is? Is this sort of what I would think of as being substance tests from GCSE chemistry or something? Or how are you going to identify what it is?
So any company should have a COSH register, which will identify the chemicals that they do have in that building. So the scenario based around this is that it doesn't conform with anything that they're currently dealing with.
Right.
Hence why they've called the fire service for assistance with this. The instruments that we've got and the tools that we can use are the First Defender and True Defender. These tools have the capability of identifying a number of hazardous substances and any everyday substance as well. So the guys are in the protective chemical suit and gas tight suit, and they'll be put into the hazard area and they'll be able to use these tools to identify what the chemical is.
So it's a machine that will work it out?
Yeah, ultimately it's a machine that will be able to analyse what the chemicals are and identify what that hazardous substance is. That will give us the correct measures and control measures for the level of decontamination that is required. That can be anything from a fine spray to wash anything off the suit, right through to a full decontam, which you can see today.
We've got two firefighters who are donning breathing apparatus in preparation to go into a gas site suit, and that's a precautionary measure because we're dealing with a chemical that we don't know, which we don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. So we have full level of PPE, which is breathing apparatus, gas sight suits, and we have testing equipment which is able to identify what chemical is involved. At the moment, if you see the incident commander, he's briefing the crew as to what he requires from them, what his concerns are, and what information he expects back from them when they get to the point of the incident.
So those tanks that the guys have got on their backs, is that so oxygen, is it, to help them breathe, or just...
It's not pure oxygen, no. It's compressed air. So we have compressed air in those cylinders, which operates at about 300 bar pressure, which gives them for a medium intensity wear, anywhere between 30, 40 minutes. But that time can be heavily reduced depending upon how hard the crews are working. Mm-hmm. In this particular situation, the guys are actually restricted to 20 minutes in the hot zone, as we call it, because they'll have gas tight suits on as well. So the impact on the firefighters wearing those gas tight suits is a lot more intense than what it would be if they didn't have them on. And that's just due to there's nowhere for the heat to escape from them as well.
And how heavy is what they're wearing?
I think on average, all the fire kit, including the breathing apparatus, not including the gas light suit, is around about 10 to 15 kilograms. And that's not including any further tools or equipment that they want to bring in with them. So it is quite a heavy load. And depending upon what the incident is, they may also have a casualty to bring out as well. So the guys are working quite hard on occasion. It's in three parts, really, for this exercise. The first one is to identify what the chemical is involved. And before we can do that, the firefighters are having to put the correct PPE on to protect themselves. Once we've done that, the second part of the exercise is to decide how we deal with that, and whether can we apply water and wash it away, whether we have to get specialist advice. And then the third part, depending upon what the chemical is the decontamination. So the large yellow tent that you can see there,
yeah,
that's our mass decontamination shower. It's supplied by water together with a washing agent, and that can wash the chemical from anyone who's been exposed to it or has it on their body. And we've also got a small heating pump there as well, and that's just to prevent members of the public, if they are going through the decontamination shower, just to prevent that cold water shock as well.
How often would you have to do anything like this for real?
It's really difficult to say, to be honest, because there's no pattern to this type of incident. We have to train as though we're going to be doing it at any time at all. So the amount of training and the variation of the training that firefighters have to go through is quite vast. Mm. I wouldn't be able to say exactly how many times we'd use it in any average month.
Yeah. So what's going on in here, Murray?
So this is the decontamination tent that we've got. This allows them to work together to be able to, while they're under the gas tight suit and under full protection, to be able to fully clean each other's suits, and then they'll come out the other side, they'll be able to derobe. So it's a case of being able to rinse the chemical off and be able to scrub that as well. There's detergent that we use with that, and it's all on the water heater as well to make sure anything's dissolved as fully as it can be. This water is then contained, and then we'll need to dispose of that in the correct manner as well, so we make sure nothing goes down the drains at all.
I did film that training exercise when I went down, so look out for that on Manx Radio's social media channels and the YouTube page as well. According to gov.im, there are 5 emergency services here on the island. The ambulance, the fire service, the police and the Coast Guard, as well as the Civil Defence Corps. I spoke to Jane Kelly, the emergency planning officer, and Civil Defence volunteer Andrew Foxon.
Civil Defence is a volunteer corps of about 40, 50 people. We provide support to the other emergency services in a whole range of areas. We train for hill search and rescue, we train in radio, we train in four-wheel drive vehicles. We are the first point of contact for setting up rest centres, should there be the need for that sort of recovery. And then a whole range of other areas of support.
40 to 50 people involved in the civil defence over here. None of them are employed, is that right? It's all volunteers?
Yep, they're all volunteers. They all have their own primary jobs, or they are retired, or we have some who've been students in the past, and they give up a Wednesday evening to do their training, and they're on call 24/7, 365 days of the year.
So all 50 or so people are on call all of the time?
So the way it works is they're on call 24/7 and they turn out if they can. So obviously we have some people who are working. So if they can, they'll leave work. If not, they'll come when they can. In the middle of the night, we get a really good response, strangely enough, at 2 o'clock in the morning, because everybody tends to be in bed. So they're free and available. But we do rely heavily on the support of the local employers on the island to actually free up the volunteers so they can respond when their alerters go off.
And is it purely responsive, or is there any stuff done by the service which involves sort of prevention or education or anything?
If we're aware of something coming up, we'll go out maybe and be preventative. So it might be that we go out and do some sandbagging in an area that's prone to flooding, if we're aware of it. Or we may be asked to just help events as well. We can go out and do we provide first aid support to quite a few of the events.
So what sorts of events might people have seen you at?
Well, we've been out supporting the Parish Walk, the Mountain Marathon, and in September we'll be supporting the End-to-End Walk. Those are our regular ones, but we provide various bits of support in other places. And for that we're providing mobile first aid and also ensuring that walkers or runners are all accounted for, liaising very closely with the marshals and the race organisers.
So you've got to be a bit of a jack-of-all-trades being part of the civil defence.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a range of skills about being able to watch. Obviously, there's a plan, there's an operational order for each event, which makes sure we have enough people to cover it. But also, you've got to be able to respond if there's an incident, if there's a need for first aid, if you come across, we come across people who are right at the end of their physical capability sometimes with the parish walk and the end-to-end, or it's a case of hydration or rehydration or getting lost. So you have to be able to respond in the moment and provide the support that's needed.
So what was the role of the civil defence like over the course of the pandemic then?
We were probably not as busy as we expected to be, but that was because the community themselves, local businesses, families, friends, all pulled together. And a lot of jobs that civil defence would do on a normal incident was being done by the communities, or government departments were being redeployed to areas that we would probably do on a normal day-to-day basis.
So what sorts of things, for example?
So we had six volunteers working with the ambulance service full-time. In fact, one's only just finished about 2 weeks ago. And they were cleaning and restocking ambulances, working on a rota with, closely obviously with the ambulance service, but with retained firefighters, retired firefighters, other members of government and volunteers. So that was our main commitment with that. But in the background we had teams obviously on call all the time to respond to anything else that went wrong, really. So we were prepared to go out if there was any flooding, if there were any weather incidents, any missing people. We were prepared to deliver food parcels.
A lot of it was that preparedness for any incidents. Yeah. We made sure that at any time we had two full operational teams available so that if any incident happened, we were able to deploy quickly.
See, I'm trying to think, if I was in distress or anything, I don't know that if I rang 999, I don't know if I would know to ask for the civil defence. You know what I mean? Which service do you require? Yeah.
You would, if you rang 999, depending on what was happening. Mm-hmm. So generally people tend to ask for the police first, unless if you've got a house fire, they'll ask for the fire service.
Yeah.
Or if they're injured, they'll ask for the ambulance service. If they're in that area where they're not sure what it is, they tend to ask for the police. And from there, the emergency services joint control room will make a decision on who responds. So in your mind, you might think you just need the police, but in the big scheme of things, they might think, well, actually, we need the fire service, we need the ambulance, we need civil defence to come and actually carry them off the hill or do something. So the decision is made by SJCR, depending on what you give them information-wise. If anybody is interested in joining us, we are always looking for volunteers to come and join us.
And how would people get in touch?
They need to get in touch with me at Emergency Planning Unit, and it's jane.kelly@gov.im, or my mobile is 331673.
Jane and Andrew there of the Civil Defence Corps. Big thanks to them, as well as David and Murray and the whole team down at Douglas Fire Station. I'll be back with the final episode of Responders next week. Don't forget, you can listen back to all of these programmes by going to manxradio.com and finding them under the podcasts page.